Tracers are chemicals that move with water as it flows through soils and the landscape. You may be familiar with tracers, particularly carbonates and sulfates. Today I'm going to be focusing on iron and manganese, particularly where they accumulate in the discharge areas and alter soil colors and other properties. Today in this talk I'll be reviewing two things. First, Darcy's law and defined hydraulic gradient, because that is controlling the tracer movement, or at least for the types of tracers I'll discuss. I'll be focusing on tracers of iron and manganese and how they relate to water movement in three different landscapes at three different landscape scales. I've picked iron and manganese because when I looked at all the papers in this conference, I think these were the only two elements left that weren't being covered in tracers or hydrology. So I don't mean to imply that they're the most important. They were just what was left over by the time I was assigned this topic. Okay, Darcy's Law. I think most of you are familiar with it, but it's a flux, or Q, equals the product of hydraulic conductivity times a hydraulic gradient. The flux is loosely related to the rate of water movement. K is permeability, and gradient is the driving force. And I'm going to be focusing most of my time on gradients today. Well, as you can see, gradient is defined as dH over L. Now, dH is just for difference, not anything calculus related. dH is the difference in total hydraulic head between an inflow point and an outflow point. Now today I'm going to be picking my inflow points as the top of the water table, so we're looking at differences in water table elevation. L is the length of the flow path, the path that the water molecules actually take. So in this particular landscape, I've got my groundwater here in blue, my water table is at the top of the blue, my inflow point is over here, my outflow point is over here at the discharge, and this is the length of the flow path, the path that the water actually takes. Okay, large gradients have a relatively large dH in this particular, in this talk. dH, again, is the elevation difference between my inflow point and my outflow point, and L is the length of the flow path. Here, dH is about half L, and so I'm going to call that a relatively large gradient. I can lower the gradient by moving my inflow point twice as far back on the landscape. This would be a broad flat, doubling the size of L, without changing dH very much. And so now I've got a small gradient, and as a result, water's going to flow slowly. Okay, for my talk today, my large hydraulic gradients will be 2% or more. I'm going to assume that water flows in these landscapes fast, or relatively fast. Chemicals will be added to or removed from pet ions that are in areas with these large hydraulic gradients. Small gradients will be 0 or 1%. In this case, water will flow through the soil slowly, and we'll be looking at chemical movement internally within pedons rather than from one pedon to another. Okay, that's all I'm going to do for hydrology. Let's just discuss the impact of these gradients on movement of iron and manganese in landscapes at three scales: pedon scale, hill slope scale, and watershed scale. All data are from eastern North Carolina, with mineral interpretations done by Purdue. And I will say that I sent slides to Daryl. He looked at the colors and told me what minerals might be present. And that's about the extent of the mineral characterization in this work. We got a little short of time. Okay, first example, broad flats, small gradients. It's 0 or 1%, 0 or less than 1%. And I'll be talking about permanently saturated sea horizons. I'm going to have a pedon back here on an inner stream divide. It's going to contain a clay layer. And notice that before the area was drained, we had a high water table, probably near the surface, sometimes above the surface, due to this very small hydraulic gradient. It just doesn't drain fast. I'll be looking at data from Ray Daniels and Erling Gammel. A particular publication was in 1978. They studied clay layers in eastern North Carolina. They said that they occur where saturation is found year-round. The clay layers have high concentrations of reduced iron, ferrous iron, and water in the clay layers is stagnant for virtually the entire year. If it were moving, they felt that the reduced iron would be removed or leached out. This is one profile. It's an umbric endoaqueous. The clay layer is down here in the sea horizon, 5BG61. It is a sand textural class. Overlying it, we have a clay loam with more traditional 10YR52 and 7.5YR58 colors. So we've got a sandy layer underneath the clay loam. High iron, ferrous iron concentration, as shown by the strong reaction to the alpha-alpha dipyridyl dye. The blue-green color, again, I think is green rust. Daryl Schultz, when looking at this photo, gave me three options, and I think green rust is the most likely. It is where you have a ferrous cation attached to a phosphate, carbonate, sulfate, or chloride anion, according to some of the literature he sent. Now, just above the clay layer, we get pore linings, or what we call pore linings as redoxymorphic features, possibly ferrihydrite. And they're occurring, as you can see, along root channels, in some cases, cracks. Now, I think they form fairly simply when root channels, or roots, make channels into the soil and coming down to, or maybe slightly within the ferrous or the clay layer, the iron will wick up and then oxidize around these channels when they encounter the aerated pores. Fairly simple explanation. Here it is again in a cartoon. You can see that the inside of the channel is all painted red and that the iron accumulation is occurring right next to the channel. Now, in these landscapes, farmers have come in and put ditches and drained the soils. This has increased the gradients up here somewhat, and we've got a faster water flow. Stagnant layers, like you saw, still occur deeper in the soil when they're below the gradient, below the ditches. It's in this zone now that the morphology does change or alter from those pore linings. This is also noticed by Ray and Erling in their earlier work. This is what you'll see in the drained area. It may look quite similar because you've got this iron-rich pore-like lining, but notice that in the center you've got some roots or root channels and they're surrounded by gray. So we've got an iron depletion occurring here around the channel, moving apparently the pore lining back into the matrix, and you see the same pattern here. So this is before drainage, and then after drainage, this is what we're picking up. It may be caused by a root coming down and dying when the water table rises in the winter and spring. We get reducing conditions developed along the channel. The iron is reduced and diffuses into the matrix. Okay, but a distinct difference in morphology. This would be a different type of tracer than this. This is what occurs after the gradients have increased and the pore linings are moving back into the matrix. And we've seen this pattern in other areas where we have drained soils. Okay, well, I should mention this is not a relic pore lining. This is a relic pore lining that is transforming into a contemporary iron mass. Kind of complicated, but I think the take-home message is this is still a legitimate morphology. All right, let's move it up a notch to another example, hill slope scale or a catena with a 2% gradient. Groundwater is going to start to move now. And I'll be using iron to determine the impact that a ditch has on hydrology. This is iron used as a tracer in this case. All right, this is from a study that I did with a student back in 2000. We've got aquic paleoudols, moderately well-drained soils up here in the upland, umbric endoaquals in the lowland. Groundwater is flowing from this upland area into the lowland to the perimeter ditch. The ditch is relatively small, about a meter wide and about 60 centimeters deep. Now today, I'm just going to look at the morphology of two plots in particular, but of a sequence of four plots. And we put plots at different distances from this ditch to see what the impact of the ditch was on the morphology. And so today I'm just going to look at these two plots and see what that looks like. At 55 meters, this is a typical BTG horizon, relatively few iron masses in the B. If you go from this point further back from the ditch, you'll see the same pattern. Relatively little iron accumulation, and the ditch has little impact at this point. If you move within 27 meters of the ditch, though, I'm not sure it's coming off quite good as good here on the screen as it is on the monitor, but this is all yellow iron masses that have formed, presumably after the ditch was dug and put in. The iron is being imported and oxidizing here, and this is an example of where the ditch has a major effect. You can quantify this. Again, this is the percent of iron masses in the BTG horizon. Within 27 or 6 meters of the ditch, we've got about 40% iron masses in the BTG. 55 and further away, we've got about half that amount, 20 to 25%. So iron is accumulating as you approach the ditch. The scenario would look something like this. Again, these are distances from the ditch in the poorly drained or the endoaquals. At low water table times in January, low water table I should say, near the ditch, the water tables are fairly high in the off season, such as January as you see here, and at this point you do have reduced water based on our redox potential and groundwater analyses. As you approach a ditch, you get this decline in the water table as the water has been drained out. Now after a rain, the water table will rise as shown here, and this is aerobic water. Our redox measurements showed it takes about 5 weeks to get rid of the oxygen here, but this still remains reduced for quite long periods. You might guess now that iron will be moving with the groundwater towards the ditch. The ditch is drawing water away from the site, and when the reduced iron hits this aerobic zone, it oxidizes into these iron masses. This is one scenario or hypothesis. The other is that the water table fluctuates quite rapidly here as well, creating aerobic conditions. Now, you can see two things. First, that the iron is moved to the discharge point, as a tracer is expected to do. And also, that the extent of the iron mass, as we're suggesting, is the extent, or the major extent, of where the ditch is having its major impact on hydrology, where it's drawing the water down the most. This matches pretty good our drain mod simulations, or model simulations, as well as other analyses. And so what we suggest is, if you want to know how far back from the ditch has having an impact, dig a series of cores from 6, 55, 73 meters from the ditch, lay them out, and see where you're getting accumulation of iron or some other obvious change. Now, not all ditches, or not all soils along ditches, will change color. The ditch must have an open outlet and be an effective drain. Not all ditches are. In fact, many are being plugged. Many are unmaintained and plugged. For soils to redden, there must be a source of reduced iron as well, and this most commonly is going to come from your upland area. So perimeter ditch systems next to an upland probably will be a good source or good candidates for having them redden near, for the reddening to occur near the ditch. And if you take a broad flat, there'll probably be too little iron, and if the ditches are spaced too closely together, you may not see much iron movement, or the soils may be oxidized. So for a number of reasons, you may not get this effect as a tracer. So how are you going to use it? Maybe you don't care about ditches. Well, I think we can use it to show us how morphology of the soils may change in areas with complex flow patterns. Now, this is a diagram from Jim Richardson. He's developed a number of these. This is just the flow lines that he's predicted would occur on a terraced landscape. And they show that discharge points will be here and here. Well, if there is reduced iron in the groundwater, then we would expect the redder BTs or BTGs or redder conditions of some type to occur at the backside of these terraces as shown, with the amount of iron becoming less and less as you get to lower and lower elevations. Oddly enough, in this area, the flats, you have stagnant water. This is where water is not moving and where we would expect very little iron accumulation to occur. And there are a number of flow diagrams that Jim has put together, and I think we can use these results to look at where the discharge points are and see if the iron is actually accumulating at those areas. Okay, my last example is going to be watershed scale. Gradients will be 2 to 5%. And this is work from Paul McDaniel, Glenn Bathke, Stan Buell, and Keith Castle. They looked at the Cecil series, typical Canhampoo adults. I think Joey Shaw was mentioning this earlier. It's got a sandy loam A horizon over a clay BT horizon with lots of manganese in the parent material. Now, it's also been found that the AP horizon had a KSAT, or saturated hydraulic conductivity, of 300 centimeters per hour. The BT had a KSAT of 1 centimeter per hour, very typical of this area. However, once you get a rainfall, a good heavy rain, a perched water table develops on top of the BT, and flow will be lateral, or down slope. This is a diagram of the landscape that Paul and his co-workers studied. It's a typical Piedmont landscape, somewhat rolly or hilly, elevation change of about 10 meters over 200 meters, and the landscape is cut by these blue lines, which are ephemeral troughs or ephemeral stream channels. They looked at a tracer that was a ratio, dithionite manganese to dithionite iron. And in this illustration, I'm just focusing on the BT horizon. The highest manganese contents or highest ratios occur where you see the black, and that clearly delineates these ephemeral troughs. And this is probably where the perched water tables remain for an appropriate amount of time to accumulate the iron, accumulate the manganese, but not let it leach too deeply into the soil. Now down here at the bottom, they found this, looks like a bald spot. This is a lighter or lower concentration of manganese. This is where the water stayed and ponded a long time, sufficiently long that the manganese did not oxidize and was actually leached. Now, I stole this diagram from Jim Richardson to illustrate what's basically going on. Maybe it's a very simple system, but during a heavy rain, you've got water tables building up on top of the BT. Manganese is reduced and dissolves. It flows into the troughs and then from the troughs downhill where it ponds here at the foot slope position. And again, if it stays there too long, stays reduced too long, it will actually leach from the system. All right, that's my three examples now with the hydrology and the gradients. Let's talk about next steps, what we might be trying in the years ahead. We are ready to move into the lab with sand tanks and recreate water tables, hydraulic gradients, and inject some dyes to see how the dye will move through the landscape. simulating not just iron and manganese, maybe, which we could actually add by itself, but also organics. Now, this is an illustration, or this is an experiment where my co-author, Sergio Abbott, set up a gradient, 2% gradient. Flow is from the left to the right. The blue is the saturated zone. This pink line denotes the capillary fringe, or the top of the capillary fringe, actually. He injected two anionic dyes. You'll note that they came down to the top of the capillary fringe, but not below it, and then flowed laterally, actually dragged laterally by this laterally moving capillary fringe, which is on top of the laterally moving groundwater. Now, just imagine if these were organics with iron and chelated organics that formed spodic horizons. Where would the spodic or the BH horizon occur in relationship to the water table? From this diagram, it looks like the bottom of the BH may mark the top of the capillary fringe, which is just above the water table. We can do the same thing with colloids or bacteria. These are bacteria that fluoresce. He set up the same gradients, inject the bacteria, and you can see with a 2% gradient, the bacteria are dragged laterally, as we would expect clay to be as well, I would think, under this gradient on top of the capillary fringe. With a 1% gradient, though, there is a vector that's downward, and so we do get some downward flow of these bacteria, or diffusion of bacteria, I'm not sure which, into and below the water table. So these kinds of experiments, I think, can be used to make our water move as we study the formation of certain types of horizons, possibly like the BH. Okay, summary of major points. Glade colors persist where the water is stagnant, and where gradients are quite low, probably zero or very close to zero. The glade horizons have large amounts of ferrous iron, possibly in the form of green rust. Ditching alters hydrology and the morphology as well. We gave you two examples where iron is accumulating near the ditch or where the pore linings are actually changing into iron masses. Iron manganese ratios may be useful tracers in the well-drained soils. Okay, but the iron before were examples of using it in discharge areas of well-drained, poorly drained soils. But for well-drained soils, maybe an iron to manganese ratio would be useful, particularly to study the perched water tables. And lastly, I think if we want to kick it up a notch, these sand tank experiments may also be very useful to study how horizons form under different hydraulic gradients rather than the more or less stagnant case where we let water move up and down. Okay, that's all I want to say. If there are any questions, I'll be happy to try to answer them. I've got references that are cited at the end of the talk. You can refer to them later. Thank you very much.
Mike, what time frame do you estimate for this pattern to occur?
Which patterns now?
After digging the ditches, for example.
I think you'll start seeing an effect in a couple of years. The amounts that you saw there, I cannot tell you because we can't date the ditch. But I have been in sites. In fact, we were basically at a site yesterday on a field trip where there was reduced iron in the site and the soil was beginning to redden, or the iron was oxidizing as we were speaking. We had to keep excavating the pit. So iron will oxidize quickly. If you've got a lot in that soil, that pattern there may occur within a couple of years of ditching and then slowly broaden over time. Dale?
What's the source of your ferrous iron in the water? I just, boy, some of that stuff sure looks like you're producing sulfides, oxidizing, and producing that ferrous iron. Same kind of thing you see if you dig a pit and there are acid sulfates, so you can get iron precipitates flowing.
The actual source, I don't know. I think the mineral studies that were done by Buell years ago. I don't even remember what the heavy minerals were or what the minerals were. We can find out for you, but I just don't know. I think he believed that they were just unweathered iron-rich materials in the parent material or in the sediments. Beyond that, I don't know. I don't know of sulfate.
The other is the iron. Well, if it's any kind of doesn't move very well, that's just, get pretty acid. So that's the problem.
It may be, Dale, but for my interest, it's there and it's moving. I mean, you know, we've got groundwater samples. It's about 5 milligrams per liter. Beyond that, I can't tell you where the source is.
I don't think it's there and it's moving. What's producing the ferrous iron?
Well, right now, I think it would be dissolution of the goethite and the ferry hydrate when the water tables rise.
Have you got organic matter down there to reduce?
Yes, yes. I've got it along my root channels.
Maybe.
Yeah. Anything else? Yeah.
Movement of iron in soluble form seems to be
In sands, that might be a possibility. But for most of the examples I'm showing here, particularly in the BTGs, you're dealing with clay loam or a clay, and I would think that's going to be tough, unless you're doing a long root channel. It's an interesting idea, though. I don't know any more than that. I think, yes, in the sands, but I'm not too sure beyond that.
When you measure 5 milligrams of iron, you use 0.45 micron filter?
I do not.
Do you use any filter?
No, I do not.
Could colloidal iron oxide be moved in your system?
I still say, maybe. Is the correct answer yes? How about we get to lunch, Mike?
Yeah, right.
I don't know, I don't care, okay? No, not another one. Marty.
Your nice, pretty green color there that you showed in front of the alpha antigen. So, could that represent green silicates, the clays that have been.
Well, Daryl gave me that as one of my options. He said that. In smectites, if we, Daryl, if you're still here, help me out. It's reduced iron in the octahedral layer of the smectites, right? Daryl, yeah, come on. Be proud here. You're telling me swing along. And I didn't think we'd have smectites in those sediments. Okay? Now, again, I told you, Marty, I'm not a mineralogist, okay? Our X-ray diffraction machine's busted at NC State. So I'm not even looking at it anymore, but I don't think we have smectites there. So I checked that one off and went with green rust. Mark?
Mike, we always talk about paralysis and some things like that going on in your system. So when you put in the ditch or when you measured, did you see a difference in the pH between, the lower areas on the landscape that where you're having the ditch effects, where you maybe see sort of the fluctuating water table now, and then you're going to get the paralysis to go on? So
well I do think the paralysis, which is oxidation of the iron, and then it will hydrolyze the water, right? Releasing the pH, releasing the proton, just in case somebody doesn't know.
Lowering the pH.
That's right, and the proton's been released. I don't worry about it. So we haven't studied it, we haven't looked.
So you didn't measure the pH?
Huh?
So you didn't measure the pH in the T system for those two sort of sampling?
We did, because we were measuring redox. The pH was 4.5 to 5. Once the water came up, we would change 1/2 a pH unit. Okay? Just in case you guys were the reviewers of that last paper I tried to find.
It's one of you, I know.
Anything else? Yes?
Your observation of this stuff oxidizing in front of you as you right after you dug it up, to me is probably that would be evidence for the green rust, because that stuff goes really fast. Rich Taylor was making this stuff at Schwerkin's lab years ago. He would wash it in ether, and he'd put it in the X-ray machine, and he'd get one X-ray pattern, and then he'd X-rayed it again, it was already oxidized and a bit cross-site.
Okay.
So that's probably
the best guess?
That would be the candidate for that.
I think so, too. Anything else? Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.